right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this is an exciting show today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did with the Iranian filmmaker Nahid Persin Sarvastani. And Nahid is the director of a really great film. It's called My Stolen Revolution. It's really a very powerful film about the situation in Iran with the rise of the Islamic fascist regime and what happened to the revolutionaries there at the time. And Nahid's film is available for everyone who can log on to Netflix and watch it. All right, so don't miss this. And this interview will give you a sense of why it's so damn important to watch this film. Before that, we'll be listening to a segment from a speech by Bob Avakian. It's a segment from the Revolution Talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And he's talking about the kind of world that we could be. He's asking people to imagine what the world could be, not what it is today. Let's not be stuck on what it is today, but let's imagine what it could be, including in the realm of art and culture. And opening the show up, many of you may remember the group Pussy Riot and how in early 2012, a number of women who were members of the group Pussy Riot invaded the Russian Orthodox Cathedral in Moscow and did a 40-minute thrash guitar concert on the altar. This was considered a tremendous, tremendous slap at the regime. They were standing up against both the Christian fundamentalist reactionary church there, as well as calling out Russian President Vladimir Putin. Three of the young women that took part in this action were put on trial, and two of them, Nadia Tolokonikova and Masha Alokina, were found guilty of hooliganism, and sentenced to 2 years in a Russian gulag for basically what amounted to a 40-second musical performance in that cathedral, a 40-second musical demonstration against the Russian ruling class and the Russian system. Now, Nadia is in one of the worst gulag prisons in all of Russia, and she's been protesting the horrible conditions of her imprisonment since she first arrived. She recently took up a hunger strike and resumed the hunger strike that she had begun in late September over conditions in the Mordovia penal colony, which is also popularly known as Penal Colony Number 14. And those conditions included having to work 18-hour days, 7 days a week. Both she and Masha Alokina were recently denied early release. They're due to be released in March of 2014, but right now people have got to keep their eyes on what's happening in those Russian gulags to the members of Pussy Riot. Joining us to talk about all this is Annika Henson, a member of Free Pussy Riot and a close supporter of the group Pussy Riot, and she's going to be talking with us now about the courageous struggles of these two women. Annika, how are you?
Very good, thanks.
Okay, and I should tell people, we are talking to you while you're in Russia today, right?
Yeah, right now I am, yeah.
Let me start out with this. What is going on with Nadia and Masha right now? What's happening with them? What's their situation right now?
Okay. The situation is difficult. Like, you know, being in prison is generally not a good thing. Both of them are in prison. They are in different prisons. Masha, she had a hearing a couple of weeks ago where they filed another appeal for her release. And the moment she appeared in court, she withdrew her appeal. Basically, we understand, and you have to understand, we have, you know, little communication with Nadia and Masha because it's all kind of filtered and censored. But our understanding is that she did it by an ethical motivation, kind of, because Nadia's situation at the same time was very difficult. She was on hunger strike. She made this press release about inhuman conditions in the prison. So Masha showed kind of an act of solidarity, and she decided to go until the end of her sentence. And both of them are supposed to be released if everything, you know, goes well. They're supposed to be released in the very beginning of March 2014.
Now, Nadia and Masha were both convicted of hooliganism. Can you tell people what that is and what their sentence was?
Well, it was a kind of a metaphorical translation of the accusation that they received, because the accusation was basically written in non-legal, non-constitutional language. They were accused, strictly speaking, of blasphemy. And because there is no such thing as blasphemy in Russian law, because our church is separated from the state and so on. So it was translated into legal terms, into hooliganism, and also conspiring, you know, a group of people conspiring to incite religious hatred. This is the actual accusation. For 14 seconds of punk prayer performed in the major symbolic Cathedral of Moscow.
Now, you said they got 4 years in jail. That's what you said, right?
Two years in jail.
Okay, two years.
For 40 seconds.
Now, let's talk about this, you know, because it's really, there's an irony there where you talk about where they accuse them. Blasphemy. No, fine. They can accuse me of blasphemy all they want, and I'll say yes, yes. But, you know, this is a very serious charge in it that wound up with these two young women being put in prison for making a stand against a very oppressive society. And the irony of them being accused of spreading religious hatred, when, as I understand it, the Russian Orthodox Church is sort of similar to most of the Christian fundamentalist churches around the world, where they, in fact, spread tons of religious hatred.
Well, yes, you can say that they're being quite fanatic, and particularly in their reaction to Pussy Riot. The fundamentalist movement generally is growing in Russia together with nationalist movement, and religious fundamentalism is on the rise, and it is, you know, actively supported by the church leaders, who are actively supported by the state leaders. Yeah, it sounds like a paradox, this kind of accusation from them, but that's the reality of it.
That's one of the things that really got me, because it's sort of you can see that an action like this that actually really, I think, and I know I saw the reaction among a lot of people hearing about this was really outstanding. A lot of people were really thrilled by, you know, around the world by the sign of, you know, yeah, like, let's stand up against this, you know?
Yeah.
Now, Nadia is in, or she was in until very recently, Penal Colony 14. Can you tell us what that is, yeah, and what are the conditions like there?
Well, it's known for its very, very harsh conditions. As far as I understand, she was the only political criminal in there. There was obviously a specific reason to send her to this prison. And, of course, like a part of a Russian judicial system, it's very untransparent. So I wouldn't be able to give you details, you know, of their routine throughout the day. But according to the Nadia statements she released, you know, there were abuses in terms of working hours, the amount of work they had to do, the hygiene conditions, censorship, just, you know, violations on violations. So finally she also received lots of psychological pressure on top of this. Personally, so she came up with this press statement disclosing all of those details, and a hunger strike consequently, and then she was hospitalized. And the funny thing that as she was in the hospital, she was supposed to be transferred to another prison, but for some reason they basically lied to her, and they took her out of hospital. And you know, when they opened the door of the car, she found herself in the same prison, you know, 14, number 14. So she announced hunger strike again. And then she was being transferred. And I think today, finally, they transferred her to another colony. But I do not know the number of this one. But it's in the same, you know, region.
Now, tell me this. You know, one of the things I found very interesting is that from the moment that Nadia went into the prison, you know, she was confronted with some things, some questions of principle that she was not going to give up on. And I think it's inspiring, the stand that she took. For instance, she said that when she first went there, they labeled her non-cooperative because she wouldn't go along with, you know, what the regime wanted done. And that was, the first thing was participating in, of all things, a prison beauty pageant.
Prison what? Sorry?
A prison beauty pageant. You know, like the women.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is also a little bit, a reference to the media coverage that Nadia received throughout the trial and later on. You know, she was featured extensively, like her face was featured extensively on covers of magazines, and there was a little bit disproportionate attention in terms of, you know, her appearance, or let's say her sexuality. It was massively used as well in media. So I guess it was a good way to make a statement about this as well for her. Yeah, because it totally goes against her feminist ideology and against the ideology of an anonymous punk band, you know, mm-hmm, which was not about the faces.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Annika Hansen, and she is a supporter, a member of Free Pussy Riot, and a close supporter of the group. And she's talking with us about the courageous struggles of two of the women from Pussy Riot who are in jail right now, Nadia and Masha. Now let's talk about this, the hunger strikes, because the hunger strike really, you know, when I read about why it was happening and what was happening, it really struck me because it seemed like, and it's related to that question I was just asking you about the beauty pageant, because it seemed like one of the things that Najee was saying was, she said, I'm protesting against the conditions that people face, but I'm doing it because I care about not just myself or all the prisoners, but about the conditions of humanity. And to me, that was really, really inspiring and compelling. And I think it was also something that made the jailers and the rulers in Russia sort of angrier, you know? So it seemed to me that there was a lot tied up in that. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the hunger strike and if you know any more about the conditions. Like, she was talking a lot about, you know, the fact that women in the prison are forced to work like these, like 18, 19 hours a day, and they get no sleep and they have no, you know, really, you know, it just seemed horrendous. So anything you could comment on that? On her motives, on
my general comment would be, you know, if we're talking about a female prison and the conditions for females specifically, and, you know, if you place it in the context of Nadia's feminist thought, let's say, then of course, you know, imagine a situation when you have all of these women prisoners, and what they're doing, they're making clothes, you know, the uniforms, basically for people from the police or from the army. Now imagine Nadia in this situation doing this. This is I think a very symbolic moment of realization of being caught in complete helplessness as a human, but double so as a woman, where you're forced to serve those against whom you rebelled, and the only way you can actually communicate about it or say no is by going on a hunger strike.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Annika Hansen, and she is a supporter, a member of Free Pussy Riot, and a close supporter of the group. And she's talking with us about the courageous struggles of two of the women from Pussy Riot who are in jail right now, Nadia and Masha. Now, tell me this. Now, Masha had also gone on a hunger strike, and as I understand it, you were referring to this earlier, when she was supposed to have a hearing, she refused to participate in her hearing in solidarity with Nadia being on the hunger strike. Okay. Now, what is the situation with Masha right now?
Very difficult psychologically. I believe that God knows what they're exercising over them, what kind of psychological instrument they're using there. But I know that she also experiences perhaps this 1 year of being in prison and then another year coming, and the realizations of the future of the collective, the realizations of, I would say, the sense of helplessness, where you find yourself, but you still keep struggling. This is the major psychological condition that they are subjected to. And I think that also my opinion, but not only mine, I think the general understanding that, you know, if you imagine Pussy Riot, which was totally built and based on the notion of horizontal decision-making and horizontal power distribution, and thank you very much for asking for Masha in this context, because there's really, and the media is so obsessed, and there's so much attention going to Nadia, and this little bit undermines the philosophy of Pussy Riot, you know? So I think this was a very, very strong appeal to media to show her solidarity with Nadia, and generally, you know, to bring some kind of equality in the media treatment of the whole process. This is my take on this, but not only mine. But any other comment, it's really hard, especially that they're not treated as ordinary prisoners. Of course, there is a massive amount of pressure on them.
Well, right. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you this. Is in fact, the fact that these penal colonies, just so people notice, and they do this in the U.S. as well, you know, like one of the most fascistic dungeons they have in the U.S. is the Pelican Bay Prison, and it's way, 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 way out there, isolated in Northern California, and it's just a, you know, it's just a terrible, terrible place, and it's in such a location that it's so isolated that family members have to, you know, really push for, make a lot of effort to even be able to get there, you know, people who live in Los Angeles or they live in other parts of California, you know, to get there to see their loved ones. And then they get there, and oftentimes they're told after making that trip, well, no, you're not allowed to see, you know, your loved one, the prisoner today or whatever. And I understand that the penal colony that Nadia's in is actually, and I guess it's true for Masha too, the point of it being so isolated and so removed from everything, it's just really, it's another aspect of trying to isolate the movement itself as well as the two prisoners. Yeah. And I'd ask you this in relation, so if you could speak to that a little bit, and this will be the last question, you know, if you speak to that a little bit, but also I want to know, is there support growing for this movement for this, for Nadia and Masha, and for the movement in Russia today?
Okay, so I'll first very briefly answer the first point that you brought up about the physical isolation, you know, as far as possible. This is a, you know, this is the way that the power tried to actually disintegrate and to break the collective in the first place. And they knew very well whom they have to isolate and for how long and how far away. So, yes, the physical isolation is very important in trying to break down the spirit of the women. And the support, well, you know, there are lots of things on the political agenda of Russia. And, of course, while people are still remembering Pussy Riot and there's a close support group and, of course, the family members and close friends, but generally, as you know, from the very beginning, the support in Russia was not fantastic. You know, it took quite a long time for people to realize that they were not just some silly little girls who came to the church because they didn't know what to do. But the society is still split on this. And in terms of international support, there are quite a lot of actions happening in Europe. And this is, you know, this is great because it's not like it's something coordinated. People are just carry on this idea and there are organized gigs and performances and just actions of solidarity. So, yeah, the idea is traveling around the world.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Annika.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. And we'll talk to you again as things develop. Keep in touch with us. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Okay. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Annika Henson, a member of Free Pussy Riot and a close supporter of the group and of the two women, Nadia Tolokonikova and Masha Alyokhina, two women from the Pussy Riot action in early 2012 of standing up and thrashing, playing, doing some thrash guitar playing in one of the most sacred and reactionary shrines in all of Russia. And they're doing 2 years in jails for a 40-second punk performance, okay? And it's for a lot more than that. It's for daring to stand up and go against all the nonsense, all the reactionary bull that's happening, you know, all the ways that the regime in Russia is no different than regimes here or anywhere else. And basically a yet another example why we need a whole new world. We will be talking with Annika again as things develop there, and hopefully maybe one day we'll get to interview Nadia and Masha themselves when they get out of jail. They're due out of jail in March, okay? But right now it's imperative that people pay attention to what's happening with these young women and not allow them to be buried under these gulags that they're currently stuck in. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian. And that excerpt is about imagining a whole different world than the mess we live in now. So stay tuned.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Welcome back. That was the late Lou Reed with Walk on the Wild Side. It's what we're going to be doing on this one is we're going to be walking on the wild side, the side they tell you you can never walk on. The side where you not only see the horror that we live in today, but the blinders are taken off your eyes and you can begin to imagine the possibility, the boundless possibilities that lay before humanity once we understand that the world does not have to be the way it is today, all right? Now, this speech was given by Bob Avakian back in the early 2000s, and it was called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, and you can access the whole speech at revolutiontalk.net, all right? So let's check this segment out now. This is Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
Just like imagining people wanted to go to work, imagine kids who actually wanted to go to school. Imagine... imagine if they weren't degraded and insulted all the time and treated as if they couldn't possibly learn anything or have any important ideas. Imagine if the educational system actually told them the truth and helped them to understand about the world and history and nature and society. Imagine if it actually helped them to think critically, to challenge everything. Yes, the teachers, yes, the administration, and yes, even the party and its leaders. What if the educational system drew the kids in, along with the teachers and staff, and said, this is a whole new society, a new world. What are your ideas about how this could all be done better? Imagine if the education combined practical things with theory, so the things they were studying and learning, they would go out into society and talk to people who did those things. Or they invite people in, instead of casting the old people off like useless garbage. Invite the old people in to talk about the horrors of the old society and their experience and what the new society means to them. And have them have an exchange with these kids in the schools. And have the kids learn practical knowledge as well as studying theory and learning science and grappling with philosophy. The same in science. Right now, science often scares people. It's intimidating. You're taught that you can't possibly understand these things, that it's all mysterious. It's not the scientist's fault. It's the kind of society, or at least not mainly, it's the kind of society we have and the way in which they want people to be divided into different classes, groups, and castes. So that some people use their minds and other people can only use their bodies or just waste away or die fighting in a war. Imagine if science were brought to everybody and made the exciting thing it is for everybody. Struggling to investigate and learn about the world and the way it works and all the different things both here on earth and in the far, what the religious people call the heavens. Imagine if here in the realm also of science, the scientists got together with the quote-unquote ordinary people, with the students in the schools, with the workers in workplaces, and talked to them about science, drew them into scientific experiments and investigation, got their ideas, found out the questions they wanted to know about the world, and then worked up ways of people uniting together and cooperating to develop experiments and investigation in science that pursued these things. Imagine if science, like education and all these other parts of society, actually were serving to transform a society, to get rid of oppression, exploitation, inequality, and to help the people throughout the world wage the revolutionary struggle to do the same. Imagine if we had a whole different art and culture. Come on, enough of this bitches and hoes and SWAT teams kicking down doors. Enough of this get low bull. And how come it's always the women that have to get low? We already have a situation where the masses of women and the masses of people are pushed down and held down low enough already. It's time for us to get up and get on up. Imagine if we had a society where there were a culture that, yes, was lively and full of creativity and energy and, yes, rhythm and excitement, but at the same time, instead of degrading people, lifted us up. Imagine if it gave us a vision and the reality of what it means to make a whole different society and a whole different kind of world. Imagine if it laid out the problems for people in making this kind of world and challenged them to take up these problems. Imagine if art and culture too, movies, songs, television, everything, challenged people to think critically, to look at things differently, to see things in a different light, but all pointing toward how can we make a better world. Imagine if the people who created art and culture were not just a few handfuls of people, but all the masses of people with all their creative energy unleashed, and the time were made for them to do that and for them to join in with people who are more full-time workers and creators in the realm of art and culture, to bring forward something new that would challenge people, would make them think in different ways, that would make them be able to see things critically and from a different angle, and would help them to be uplifted and help them to see their unity with each other and with people throughout the world in putting an end to all the horrors that we're taught are just the natural order of things. Imagine all that. This is not some kind of fantasy I'm talking about. This is what's been done in socialist societies. It's what's been done in the Soviet Union, even more so in China, in the time when our class, the proletariat, held power. This is what's been done in these spheres and every other part of society. Yes, we're going to have laws and a constitution in socialist society to protect the people, to protect their interests, and to protect their rights. But more than that, we're going to rely on the people. We're going to bring forward the people. We're going to enable them to wrangle with things and to thrash things out themselves collectively. We're going to lead them to challenge everything, to transform everything, to bring into being this whole new world and to do it together with the people of the world. And what I'm talking about, again, is not a fantasy. These are the things that have been done in the socialist societies that have existed, or they're the things that on the basis of that experience we have summed up and are learning more deeply need to be done. This is all possible. It's not some pipe dream. This is what happens when the mass of people rise up and take control over society. And this is what waits to be done.
All right. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And you've just been listening to a segment of a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The speech is called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this segment is about imagining a whole different world, a world where humans can live with all the dignity that human beings should have. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Nahid Persan-Sarvastani, the Iranian filmmaker, about her film, My Stolen Revolution. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Funky Rebel from the Soul Rebels. Now, this next segment of the show is something that I feel very strongly about. You know, after the most recent upsurge of protests in Iran, filmmaker Nahid Persan-Sarvastani remembered a time when, as a young activist, she fled Iran after the 1979 revolution. And in remembering those times, she began a quest to find her surviving friends, many of whom were, like her, a revolutionary. Nahid escaped Iran, but many of her friends had been jailed, tortured, and executed. Her brother Rostam was also executed. Nahid set out to find what had happened to her friends in the horrifying torture chambers of the Islamic fascist regime and what her brother's final days were like. Now, Nahid found her surviving friends, and out of this quest was born her film, My Stolen Revolution, a deeply moving and intensely powerful narrative that everyone should know about. Nahid talks with and listens to her friends' stories and through them reconstructs a shared past, equal parts harrowing and inspiring. When I recently saw the film My Stolen Revolution, I was extremely moved by the film. Yeah, just had to sit in my seat for a while and contemplate what the hell was being shown on the screen and how really important it was. And I wanted to bring that to listeners of this show. So I'm really happy to welcome the director of My Stolen Revolution, Nahid Persan-Sarvastani. And she's just a wonderful director, writer of the film. Nahid, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, why don't you tell listeners what the film is about? Give them a sense of what the film is.
The film is about my searching after my friends and for 30 years ago when they were arrested and put in prison. And it's also about my brother's arresting and what happened to him the last days of his life in prison before he was executed.
What made you want to make this film in particular?
It was 2009 when it was election in Iran, and I saw at the TV the people demonstrated in outside the on the street, and it was and the people, the young people, were arrested again and they were killed. So then I saw all the pictures, I couldn't, because I ignored everything that happened before. So I thought I can't ignore the situation in Iran, and I have to do something. And my first reaction was that I have to find my friends. What happened to them? Well, who are alive and who is not? So it was why I began with the film.
Now, when you say that you ignored everything that happened before, actually, you have to explain to people, there was a large part of history in Iran that you did not ignore, that you were part of. So What do you mean you ignored a lot of what happened?
I mean, I was an activist in Iran before the revolution and also after the revolution. I was very active and my family was also active. But, you know, just after the new regime, the Islamic came to the power, they began to arrest all people who did the revolution, who was a part of the revolution. So we were forced to go underground and be active like that. But when they began arrest all my friends and also my brother, it was one night when they arrest all my friends and my brother. So I just flew the country. And after that, you know, after 6 months, they killed my brother in prison. And, you know, it was so hard for me that I couldn't take it. I couldn't understand what has happened. So I can say that I ignored all the pain in 30 years. And when it was election 4 years ago and people were arrested and killed, it was like it happened again. It was like a repeat for my friends. So I ignored it because it was so painful to understand what happened with my brother. So I felt guilty. I felt guilty because I was alive, but not him. But when I saw all the pictures, I couldn't just ignore it anymore.
Now, after people were arrested, there was that first wave of arrests. And as you said, your brother and all of your friends were arrested. You didn't leave the country immediately. You stayed in the country underground for a while, right?
Yes, I stayed in the country for 6 months because I didn't know that they are going to stay so long in 30 years. I thought, okay, we fight again and we maybe win, but we didn't do that. So when they killed my brother, so I had to go because I was afraid that same thing happened to me and my family.
Now, one thing I know from friends, from Iranian friends and from writers here in this country who are friends who went to Iran in 1979 and, you know, were there in the aftermath of that. And they said that for a while there was just a period of such celebration that people had, that it was such a revolutionary spirit in the streets, and the Shah was gone, and you know, and I know that how bad the Shah's regime was. I mean, I had, as I said the other night in the film, you know, I had many friends who
were murdered by the agents of Savak. Savak, just for people who don't know, Savak was the U.S. trained and financed secret police of the regime of the Shah of Iran, the regime that the U.S. had put in power in the early 1950s after a U.S.-sponsored coup. And Savak was just a band of the most brutal butchers in the world. There was one man I knew who watched Savak cut his son's arms off, they tried to use that to force him to talk. Another man whose feet were baked on a hot plate. You know, and Savak was one of the most notorious and brutal torturers in the world. And when the Shah was overthrown in a revolution, it was such a...
That night I remember so clearly, it's like it happened now. So when we were on the street with cars, everybody just, what's that when you, the sound of...
blowing the horns on their car.
Everybody did that, and we were so happy. If something happened to my car, so the other came and helped us, and everybody celebrated in Iran. So we thought it was democracy now and we were free. But it just took some days that we understood that something is wrong. It's not what they promised us, the Islamic. So I remember when I worked at a newspaper in my city, Shiraz, and we didn't have any mail, but they came to say, "And from now we have to have mail when you work." So it was like it was a joke for us because we did everything for freedom and now we have to have veil. So it was like, you know, the first day they said very soft that you have to have veil, and the other second day you have to have that. So it took just maybe 6 months, then we understood that we are in danger.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Iranian filmmaker Nahid Persin Sarvastani about her film, My Stolen Revolution, which tells the story of the aftermath of the Islamic fascist regime taking over in Iran and the way they buried the 1979 revolution against the Shah of Iran in blood. My Stolen Revolution is widely available on Netflix.
Now,
you left the country, and as you said, your friends and your brother and thousands and thousands of other people all around the country were thrown into jail.
Now, you lived 30 years in exile in Sweden before you actually reached the point where you felt you really had to do something.
There's a very moving point in the film, in the beginning of the film, when you're telling this story and you say, I sat down and I decided I had to look for my friends, as you were indicating earlier in the interview. You had to look for your friends. Tell us about how you looked for your friends and what you found, because I was so moved by the point where you're saying, I found so many had been executed. Yeah. And you just started crossing off names and you're thinking, where is she going to stop? And you were just going down a list and one line through the other. So let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, when I decided to find my friends, I tried, you know, internet was the first, I think, because I couldn't remember all the names. So it took a while to remember the names. And I also contact an organization who work for the ex-prisoners. So I asked them and they refreshed my mind. So I wrote all the names that I have to look for where they are. So yeah, most of my friends in my organization were executed. But in the end, when I found some friends outside the country, that they were in exile, they were put in prison, but they, after almost 10 years, they could go to permission and they flew from the country, and they were in USA, in Sweden, Norway, Germany, and England. So I just called them and went to them. So it was very, you know, special to meet them, because to meet my friend, I have a lot of friends in Sweden and even in Los Angeles, but those friends, they are different because they are like me. All their ideologies was, I didn't need to do anything to make them understand me. So because it was like come home again. So it was very nice. But when I heard all their story in prison, it was very hard. It was before that, I didn't want to hear anything what happened to them, because it was hard to know that. But now, when I decided to know everything, so it was horrible stories they talked. One of my friends were raped in jail when her daughter, who was just 1 year, was with her in jail. So I compared myself with her, because we were in same age and our daughters were very same age, but I could flee from the country, but not her. So she was in jail, she was raped, she was tortured all the time. And she also, her daughter, who was just 1 year, did same thing to her toy as the interrogated dude did. She beat it, the toys, and the mother was like, she was so sad that it happened to her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this, because there was so much that was revealed with your friends when you finally got together with them, you know. And well, first, actually, let me ask you this: the friends you found, I understand that these were some people who agreed to talk with you, but there were a lot of people that you contacted who, one, the experience in prison had done tremendous damage to, mm-hmm. and there were people who didn't want to talk. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that experience and find what happened when you actually found these women.
Yeah, I found a lot of people, but some of them were so ill, psychologically ill, that they couldn't be in my film because of all torture, psychology and physically torture. So they just wanted to forget everything. But of course they can't forget, but to talk about it again, it was hard to them. So they couldn't be, they didn't want to be in my film. And some of them, they collaborated with the regime, so they were ashamed to talk about that. And the people who are in my film, they didn't want to, that the people who were collaborated attend to my house. So I choose 5 or 6 women, and they come to Sweden, all of them, and we talk about everything in my house.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Iranian filmmaker Nahid Persin Sarvastani about her film, My Stolen Revolution, which tells the story of the aftermath of the Islamic fascist regime taking over in Iran and the way they buried the 1979 revolution against the Shah of Iran in blood. My Stolen Revolution is widely available on Netflix. What were some of the most, aside from your friend who was raped in prison, and that was an extremely moving moment in the film, what were some of the other things that were struck you very hard, very deeply, when you talked to these women about their experiences in prison?
One of the experiences was when they put all the, they were just young girls, they put them in a coffin because they, after many torture, many sort of torture, they stayed very strong, and they, because they had a goal, they wanted to change the world, so they didn't collaborate with the regime, and they used another method, they interrogated, used another method to put them in coffins. They built 150 coffins for just girls who were leftists, and they put them there. They have to sit down and don't move, don't see, because they were blindfolded. They couldn't hear anything because it was either very, very silent, or the Quran was played very loud 24 hours a day. They just had 1 minute to go to the toilet. So if they didn't come after 1 minute, they just took them out. So if one of them moved, so they were beaten. So all that to break down their psychology, I think it was that. And I can say 90% of the girls, they just they became mad, or they helped the regime. They became a torture. And one of the women in my film told me that they were worse than the interrogated, because they hit us much harder than the other people. So it was, in the Shah's regime, they just torture people physically. But in the new regime, it was both physically and psychology. So it was very hard to hear them. And when I heard all the stories of torture, so I just thought, how could I be if I was put in jail? Would I be a torture, or would I be executed, or just be strong? So it's, you don't know how you react when you be tortured.
You know, there's one woman in the film, I can't remember her name, but they beat her knees and destroyed her knees. And she was also an artist, and she really, the work that was displayed in your film was remarkably powerful, really beautiful and really powerful. Can we talk about her a little bit? Because she seemed to be, and this was true of a lot of the women in the film, the women that you brought together, most of them, for the most part, were exceptionally defiant. They remained defiant today, and they were clearly, you could see, when they were in jail, they were not like, oh, well, I'll give it. They were like, no, to hell with you. I'm not, you're not going to break me. I mean, it was really, really very heavy.
Her name is Parvane. She was 17 when she was arrested. And it was her school, what's the director? What's the name of school? It was the school principal who gave her name to the police, and they came and arrested her. She was so teeny. She's short, and she was full of energy, but she wasn't a political activist from beginning. But when they put her in jail and they tortured her, and she saw all the young people in jail that they were tortured, she became a communist inside the jail. So, they thought they could break down people, but they didn't do that because they were so strong together. And she told about that she painted a lot in the prison. She painted her friends who were executed to remember them. But she was beaten because of that. Yeah.
There's one part that she did too where she created, and it emerged through the course of the story when they were at your, when you were at her house, I guess, and you saw these sculptures that she did, and they were phenomenal. And when you looked at them, and the way it depicted, and it was an ever present. It was ever present in your discussion with her, but then she brought them to Sweden with her, yeah, to your house. Yeah. And it became sort of a central point of these women's lives right there. This was here, yeah, what they had been through.
Yeah. This girl, her name is Sudabe. It's another girl, because all the prisoners, they did something creative in prison. But this girl, her name is Sudabe, and he was an artist before she was an artist before she was put in prison. And when she was in prison, she tried to continue to paint. And she hadn't anything, any material to use. So in the prisons, she just cut her hair with something he had, and with a toothpicker. So she made a brush, and with teeth, because sometimes when they get teeth, she put the teeth inside and painted with the teeth and the brush from her hair, and did a lot of painting. But she wasn't allowed, so she told me that she did more, much more than we see in the film. But they took that from her. And they even forced her to paint Khomeini. But she didn't do that. That was because she was tortured a lot.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Iranian filmmaker Nahid Persin-Sarvastani about her film, My Stolen Revolution, which tells the story of the aftermath of the Islamic fascist regime taking over in Iran and the way they buried the 1979 revolution against the Shah of Iran in blood. My Stolen Revolution is widely available on Netflix.
Did you get any sense of, as defiant as these women all were, did you get any sense of what kept them, what gave them strength while they were in prison like that? Because they were in there anywhere from 6 years to 10 years. And, you know, they really, I mean, it was very inspiring to see that they weren't broken, mm-hmm, you know, that they actually stood, and they could even, and even today, I guess only one or so of them is still active, but it was like, you could see even today when they talk about prison, it was, we were not going to give up then. We were not going to, and they don't have a lot of respect for people who did cave into the regime. So let's talk about that.
You know, when you have a strong ideology, when you want to change your country, to have a similar life for everybody, so you become strong. And they were together, all those people, they were together, and they support each other in prison. So it was why they get stronger. But of course, some of them, they couldn't stay to be tortured. But one of them, Nazli, who was also put in coffin, and she was strong. She said that she make flowers with bread, because they sometimes when they get food, so she saved the food and she made flour with bread, and was that from water from month. So she did it, and she made a flower, and she thought, oh, it's very beautiful. She wasn't alone. She was with a flower. Or she imagined that she's driving to her house, from her house to her mother's house, and go, and you know, every day they were very busy in their mind to get stronger, to don't break out, because they knew what regime wanted. The regime wanted to them be very isolated and not doing anything.
You know, this, you concentrated on a small group of people. Give people a sense of, this was a huge phenomenon. I mean, there were so many people stuffed into the jails. They even built new jails. They did this whole thing. I mean, there was a whole generation almost of people were in these jails. And, you know, to give people a sense of how massive this repression was, the executions, the torture, how big was this? How much of an impact was this?
Mm-hmm. Every day, it was what the women told me. Each night they could executed 100 to 300 people just in Evin, in Tehran. So how many were executed, nobody knows about that. But just during 1.5 months, they executed 4,000 or 5,000 people without any judgment, nothing. They just executed them. And other prisoners, they could hear that when their sister or brothers were killed, because they did it outside the cell, because it was also a kind of torture for the prisoners. So when you know that your brother is there and they are going to shoot him and they hear that, so it's a sort of torture.
You know, I had two friends, actually, both of whom they were involved in the Amal Uprising. And the Amal Uprising happened in January of 1982, and it was the first attempt to launch an armed struggle as part of an overall revolution against the Islamic fascist regime. Now, you know, just so many people, I don't know how many thousands of people were arrested and many executed, including many of the revolutionary leaders in Iran. And these two people, their husbands were arrested with them, and both of them, their husbands were executed. And one of them told me that the most terrible thing for her was that they executed her husband right exactly at that point. They executed him under the window of her cell, and she could hear it. And she also had told me that what they would hear at night, and she was one of the women that was in this coffin, and she was stuck in a box all the time, 24 hours. And she said she could hear at night the gunshots. Yeah. And she said it was the worst thing that she had to listen to.
Yeah.
That was the worst experience, more than they could have ever tortured her physically,
yes.
Hearing those gunshots night after night. And then that one night when she knew her husband, and she was straining to look out the window to try and see if she could see him, and she knew that each shot that she heard, one of them was her husband.
Yeah, it happened to all of prisoners. Parvone, who was just 17 years, she told me the first night when I was in prison, so I heard that, I saw that all the prisoners go to the windows and try to hear, and she didn't know what happened. What's happening? Why are you there? What's the sound? Why is that? So she didn't know what it was. So all, you know, all those girls or boys, they were just between 13 and 26. So they were just child. And they have to hear that their people, it doesn't matter if it was their sister or brothers or, but I can't find any words how awful it was for them to hear everything.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Nahid Persson-Sabristani. And Nahid is the director of the film My Stolen Revolution, a very powerful and moving film about the experience of Iranian revolutionaries in the torture chambers of the Islamic fascist regime in the days immediately after the Islamic fascist takeover of the revolution in Iran. My Stolen Revolution is widely available on Netflix. Nahid, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, what was the most... Before we get into, well, I'll ask you this one first. What was the hardest thing that you learned in the course of this film?
When I heard how they were tortured in prison, because all the time I thought, because I didn't want to hear how my brother's life was in prison, because I wished that he would just was executed. I didn't want to know that if he was tortured or not. When the women in my prison, in my film, talk about all kind of torture, and I didn't want to think, okay, it happened the women, not my brother. But in the end, when one of them, Munir, who is very activist now, she said, yes, it was worse in that prison. So it was the hardest one to her, that my brother was tortured before he was executed.
What was the most inspiring thing that you learned through your interaction with these women and learning about all this?
I was happy and the hope that there are so many strong people, because all those people in my film, they are very strong. And it was for me to continue make more films and to continue fight for freedom and democracy.
That was something I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned in the director's statement, a couple of other places, even in the question and answer the other night, you talked about what you wanted to accomplish with this film, what you want people to bring from this film. Can you talk about that? What do you want people to get from this film?
You know, people in other countries like USA, even if you don't think you have freedom, you are free to speak. What I want of people that when they see the film or if they heard of anything about those projects, support them and try to spread it to internet and help Iranian, because they need our help outside the country. They can't do anything without our help.
One thing I wanted to make sure that people knew too is that, you know, because look, Iran is a very hot question in this country. And it has been since the overthrow of the Shah. There has always been an attempt to whip people up against the Iranian people. And when you said the other night, you said you did not want this film and what happened to these women and to the Iranian people under this Islamic regime, you didn't want that to be an excuse for the U.S. and Israel to launch a military attack. Let's talk about that.
A lot of people, they think, we hope that the USA or Israel attack Iran. But ask Iranian people, do they want that? No, nobody in Iran wants that U.S. or Israel attack Iran, because we know everybody that it's about money. It's not about people. They don't care about people. They don't care about the chemical weapon. It's just money and take. It's like Iraq. What they said that there is a nuclear weapon in Iraq, but they didn't find it. It's about oil. So when I talk about support Iranian people, I mean people should do that. American people should do that.
All right, Nahid, thank you very much for sharing your story with us today. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Iranian filmmaker Nahid Persan-Sarvastani about her film, My Stolen Revolution. We're going to have to run to get out of here real quick. But first, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Nelish Lalani, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow us, you can do so on Twitter and Facebook, and go there and just check everything out there. Like us on Facebook. Let's build this thing up and get it out all over the country, all right? And remember, as you look at the world and understand how horrible it actually is, and you're wondering about what it's going to take to change this, you should always, always go first to the site revcom.us, all right? That's revcom.us. That's where you're going to learn why the world is the way it is and what we can do to change it. We're going to go out now with one more tribute to Lou Reed, and this is All Tomorrow's Parties. Talk to you again next week. Hand-me-down dress from who knows where.